I was very impressed today to come visit the campus. It's beautiful. They got a lot of great things going on here. I met with the innovation office to start with before I did the luncheon. And it's been really exciting. And one of the things that's really exciting is I'll show you in my presentation what we're up to. But I'm happy to announce that we got a handshake on a deal with the University of California at Santa Barbara this morning, and that makes them. We've done several deals with different universities in the UC system, but UC Santa Barbara is now our flagship campus. They're the ones that we have done the most with, and we're happy to have the relationship. So congratulations to you all. The intellectual property and invention, and what I'm talking about is the emergence of an efficient market. So as I start going into this and you say, what the heck does this have to do with intellectual property invention? Bear with me and I'll get to it, okay? My hope is to try to get through the presentation part in 30, 40 minutes and then plenty of time for all of you to ask questions and so forth. I think that's the timing that Bill described to me. So let's go ahead and get started. First, I want to talk about inefficient markets. Now, I know that this is a technology conference, but economics plays heavily into innovation and bringing things to market. So let's say you want to invest some money into a business, and say this business is a shipping company. You want to ship things from the UK or something like that. One of the things you may or may not be well versed in is the risks, how to value the company, who are the other investors, what are the potential returns, so on and so forth. It's really tough for you to understand these things, so chances are you're going to go get somebody to help you understand that. You're going to have to rent some expertise somewhere or get an additional partner or something of that nature. This is how this shipping business occurred in the 1600s. 1600s, 1700s, there was an underwriter who would more or less provide insurance. He would say, hey, that boat that's going over to the New World, it's going to carry, you know, whatever, fabric or whatever, and it's going to bring back, you know, goods from the New World. And they, you know, lots of storms, ships would sink, captains were you know, didn't know what they were doing and so on. But it was pretty much one-off. A person would invest, and they'd invest in the ship, and it was a ton of risk. And it was a very inefficient market because all of the underwriting was in one place. People tended to ask very high cost for the premiums and so on. And there was actually problems on both sides. In some cases, the underwriter would say, oh, that wasn't in the expected event, so I'm not paying. And sometimes the captain would go get two or three different people, not tell them, and then he'd scuttle the boat because he got paid two or three times. So there was a lot of inefficiencies in the market, and things didn't work well. So now we're going to move to a little bit further. And you saw that there's lots of ships going and lots of people underwriting. And ship owners, you know, were desperately out there trying to get different underwriters to help fund them. Now, let's move forward. There was this guy named Lloyd. And Lloyd wanted to sell coffee. He had a coffee house down by the docks. And he wanted to sell more coffee. And he knew that underwriters would get together with captains. And he wanted him to come there and buy his coffee. So what did he do? He started putting up the ship's manifests so that they'd all come there and the underwriters could walk around, they could look at the manifest. Then he started adding more information about the history of the captain, the cargo, what the markets were, and things of that nature. And lo and behold, you started having two or three underwriters standing there looking at one of the manifests, and they said, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. How about you? And they said, yeah. So next thing you know, they had them coming together, and not only that, Lloyd was excited about this because he was selling a lot of coffee, and so he actually got people to do ratings and things of that nature, and lo and behold, not too long after that, the Society of Lloyd's was born. It became known, one of the largest insurance companies, and still is today, it's called Lloyd's of London, if you don't know. And this is how it started. It started because there was a more or less a meeting place, an intermediary that helped them understand, and they were able to pool the expertise. They were able to get managing agents to understand it, pull brokers together. A lot of these additional businesses spun out of that, But at the end of the day, more capital flowed into it from different sources. The people invest, the underwriters actually wound up paying less because they spread the risk out all over many different ships. And lo and behold, people paid less to get into the business, and everyone made more money out of it. So it's actually one of those beautiful things that happens sometimes when an efficient market actually is spawned. And then there's all kinds of the surrounding businesses that take place as well. So these are part of the rules of what makes an efficient market. You get silos of expertise that are brought together. You have to take a gut feel and convert it to, you know, some sort of expertise-based, so something calculated. One of you might want to start a business. You might want to sell a product. Well, you have to go research. You have to figure that out. You have to take it from the gut feel and take it to something that's more known. You have to provide an avenue for lots of capital to come in. You have to make sure that there's a way for lots of investors to come in, because that creates the competition. As more capital comes into it, more sellers are brought to it, and lo and behold, a market's born. Actually understanding the risk and so on, and reliable return and so on, is very important. It's really important for people to understand what the risk is, how much they're going to put into it, what the rate of return is, and that way they can make a business decision. So what happened here was it just created more certainty for both the underwriter and the people being underwritten. And because they were talking to each other, the abuses that you saw before didn't occur anymore. Captains couldn't scuttle their ship by getting insurance from two or three different places, because they got it from those two or three people were now brought together. So it's a very interesting thing that occurred. Okay, let's fast forward. And I just giving you a couple examples. 1980s, savings and loan industry. I don't know how many people remember this time frame, but during the late 70s, early 80s, probably a lot of you don't, okay. I see a few fellow people of my age that might remember it. But anyhow, the savings and loan industry was charging double-digit interest rates. And in fact, in some areas, according to how much risk there was, it was even as high as 20%. At the time, I lived in South Florida, and they had these things called hurricanes that would blow through all the time. And because the lenders were localized and lending to a local market, you had these local effects that would drive the rates way up. So you try to get a mortgage in Florida, they're going to say, you might lose your job because a hurricane's going to blow through, the house might blow over. 21% was your interest rate. It was just crazy. It was difficult for people to do that. Also, for example, there was other situations in West Virginia where they had the miners. You had, when the mines were on, people were making tons of money. And they'd go and they'd get mortgages and they'd buy cars and they'd get money from the lenders. But lo and behold, the mines would shut down and things would dry up. And so it was a very, very inefficient market. In order for a lender had a lot of single borrowers, and this was pretty much the situation. In Oklahoma, they had regional problems. In California, they had problems, and so on and so forth. And it was an inefficient market because everything was one-to-one. What happened? Well, there was actually a fallout from a regulation problem. The interest rates were regulated by the federal government, both the interest rates that could be charged for mortgages and the interest rates that they could give you in savings. And what happened was, is because they were regulated, people pulled their savings out and put it in, you know, higher, you know, like the stock market, things that yielded a higher return. And lo and behold, because technically the banks became insolvent. And when they became insolvent, the government looked for a way to buy up all these mortgages. And Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae was born. And it was actually a bailout program for the banks. But it had a beautiful side effect. And what was that side effect? The side effect was that now you had a nationwide place that would underwrite your mortgage. And so lo and behold, mortgage rates became uniform across the country. The risk was spread out, and you know, you could actually even get your mortgages straight from these, or you could get them from a bank when it was underwritten by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And a whole set of extra industries grew up out of that. And you had a lot of beautiful things that now, I mean, you can go online, you can go to a LendingTree, and you can get five or six banks will bid for your mortgage. That was unheard of before. You had to go down the street and you had to beg, you know, sometimes it was your Uncle Fred, okay? You just, and now this beautiful market that has come about. There's a lot of additional examples that we can talk about. We can talk about the New York Stock Exchange. We can talk about the Chicago Board of Trade. What used to happen, even as little as 20 years ago, you had to go to a broker, and you had to call that broker in order to get a sell order or to buy stock and so on, and they charged enormous fees. Now you can go online and you can get a discount broker, and you can buy into any stock for a few bucks. And so that the internet has enabled a beautiful, efficient market there. Tickets, you know, you can aggregate tickets. You can get the best price at places like Priceline, Travelocity, stuff like that. They can show, so the competition has created a better experience for the consumer. Music, ASCAP and BMI. Like many engineers, I have an artist brother. He writes music. Okay, he's a composer, and sometimes he does really well, and sometimes he doesn't. But the beautiful thing about it is they've got it figured out in the music industry. He writes a song, and some other artist wants to record that song. It's all done. Everybody knows how much each other gets paid. Every time it's played on the radio, he gets a little bit, the artist gets a little bit. It's all figured out. Why? Because ASCAP and BMI have, you know, brought, they were a trusted intermediary to bridge the gap between the artists and those that wanted to, you know, play the music and so forth. Secondhand goods, everybody sort of understands what's happened with the eBay phenomenon. It's pretty amazing. It's all but put, you know, resellers of used goods out of business. You know, there's still, you can still find, you know, antique shops and stuff in local areas. But for example, the sports card system, it now is, you know, it's a thriving business on eBay. And in fact, used sports cards sold on eBay is about five times the volume of new sports cards being sold, dollar-wise. So it's a pretty interesting, you know, phenomenon. Overstock, you didn't sell all those things you expected to sell. People didn't go for a fuchsia bed sheets. That's okay. Overstock will take care of it for you. Okay, they actually will find the people living wherever they live that want fuchsia. Okay. Oh, let me go back. Sorry about that. This is a real interesting one, real estate. Many of you have purchased real estate. Many of you will soon. It is a very, I think, still an inefficient market in large extent. It's very regional. Prices are set regional. And you're paying 6% or whatever to someone who basically is providing marketing for you. Now, in many cases, they provide a lot more services, and some of them are really worth it, and some of them are not. But it's still an inefficient market, because if I'm trying to move to wherever, if I'm trying to move across the country, I pretty much have to go there and see all the homes, understand, I have to hire myself an agent, and I have to you know, do a one-off until I get so tired and fed up that I just buy something instead of actually being able to browse and find the home of my dreams. So things like multiple listing service came into being that created more efficiency in the market. I can now browse homes online and so on. And there's some new interesting things going on. Companies called Redfin and Zillow are actually trying to pioneer, bring down the commission rates, and also provide, you know, secondary verification of prices of homes and things of that nature. So that's one that's emerging. There's even, believe it or not, an exchange for pollution credits. Believe it or not, companies that create pollutants, they can actually, they get a certain amount of credits, and if they don't pollute enough, they can sell it to somebody who is. And so it's just amazing the types of exchanges and markets that are being born nowadays, especially because of the availability of great communications and expertise. So this is sort of the lesson here of efficient markets. Free market forces will drive inefficient markets to efficiency if we allow it. Scale and aggregation are key components of many efficient models. Something has to get it to where it's not one-to-one. It has to be many-to-many. More ubiquitous access to information is very key. People have to be able to get the information on their own or through a reliable, trusted source about the risk and about the potential return. Efficient markets enable secure, significant capital to be provided and to be brought in, and this liquidity buoys everybody. So when more money goes into the market, there's more money for the people selling, and there's better value for the people buying. Efficient markets drive costs down, profits up all the way across. Okay, so what's this have to do with intellectual property and invention? We are trying to get people to think about intellectual property as a market. That's part of what we're about. Okay, intellectual property is something that can be bought and sold, believe it or not. It's a property right, much like buying a house or buying a bunch of pieces of property and building an office building on it or something like that. You can buy a bunch of pieces of intellectual property and build products out of it or technology. So here's the theory. Patent system provides incentive for invention disclosure. That's provided long time ago by the Constitution. If you disclose your invention, you'll get exclusive use of that invention for a limited period of time. Right now, it's 20 years from the day you file it. And the intent was if you disclose it, then other people can read about your invention and they can get ideas from it and build on top of it, okay? And then, of course, they'd have to come to you to be able to practice your invention. How much incentive is appropriate for practicing? What's the proper time period? There's all kinds of questions right now that people are asking. Is 20 years too long? I mean, now that we live in the internet age, what's the right thing? What kind of exclusivity? What are appropriate, you know, risk, rewards, and so forth? And what effects are there? Patent claims are very stylized. One of the things that I like to say is you could get 20 patent attorneys in the room and ask them to write 40 patents, and they'll use 35 different styles to do it. Okay? It's just sort of the way. They attack different inventions different ways and so on. So it's not a model of clarity. It requires some level of expertise to even understand what's going on. Okay. Patent system right now, I think most people would agree, it's kind of messy. It really is. Most people want to take a patent, and the ideal thing, people that invented something, you want your invention to be used. You want it to be built. You want people to use it. That's what you want. There, in 1999, there was a book written called Rembrandt's in the Attic, and some of you may be familiar with it. A lot of entrepreneurs especially people in businesses and so on have read that book. But the principle and the concept there was companies create a lot of innovation. And if you looked at your list of innovations, you'll find that you're not using that many of them. Okay? And so you can actually take the ones that you're not using and you could go out and sell it to other people and get money for it. Okay? And it's a wonderful idea, but reality is that it doesn't really work that well. For example, if you're a company and say the company I used to work for, Intel, and they have patents on their microprocessors, and that's what their main product is. But let's say also, because of the research and development, they got patents on internet browsing, okay? And they don't make internet browsers, so they go and they talk to Netscape or Internet Explorer or Mozilla or somebody like that, and they try to say, hey, you need to license this from us because some of this technology you're using, we actually invented that. Well, what's going to happen? Say they go to Microsoft and talk to them. Well, Microsoft is going to say, yeah, but you're going to have to talk to us about these processor patents that we happen to have. And so it isn't a reality that they actually can do that. They wind up trading or they get in a big fight and lawyers buy new summer homes or something like that at the end of the day. And it's a very inefficient market and not necessarily the way you want to do it. A successful licensing program requires several things. Huge amounts of resources. You've got to have highly specialized technical, legal, and licensing expertise. You've got to have a lot of money. Unfortunately, in order to have these engagements and talk to people and try to convince them, you actually have to, you know, pay for all this expertise and put together a case. And lots of patience. Because it usually starts with some sort of Well, it doesn't necessarily always start from a standpoint of trust. And so consequently, it takes a long time to build up a relationship and actually build up trust. So say one of you invents something and you want somebody else to use it. And I think I was talking to Aaron today. And if that's the case, it's something it's really difficult. Because when you approach a company, they don't trust you. They wonder what you're up to. They say, is this person going to try to build a case against me? Is that why he's talking to me? Is that why he's showing me this? Because he's going to hire an attorney and file a suit against me? Or something of that nature. So my advice was, get in the door and through some avenue that helps build a level of trust. It's very, very important if you want to talk to somebody about license your invention. So use whatever contacts you can or whatever and help them understand that you're really looking for a win-win. Lots of patience. 18 to 24 months are usually required. If you wind up in litigation, I think the RIM litigation took 6 or 7 years, actually. And you also need credibility. That's that trust issue that I was talking about. The other thing is that everyone seems to have unreal expectations for their innovations and their inventions in most cases. They'll go to somebody, they talk to them, and they're offering, an order of magnitude or two less than what they think their invention is worth. And so it tends to encourage, because it takes a long time, because the money isn't offered what they expected and so on, it encourages them to swing for the fences. They hire a contingency attorney and they file the lawsuit. And the unfortunate thing is that usually some huge amount in that case, 40% or thereabouts, winds up going to the attorney instead of going back into something that will spawn innovation. The origin of everybody's heard of something called a patent troll, and it's really interesting. When I worked at Intel, it was actually when this term was created. We were fighting a patent case against somebody called, it was TechSearch, and they, I think it was, or it may have been one of the others, but nevertheless, they were coming to Intel and asking them to give them money, and they were actually, we didn't necessarily agree with the way that they were doing it, and so the VP that was there in charge of license litigations and patents, his name was Peter Detkin. He called them, I think in a press article, he called them one time patent extortionists. Well, that appeared to be fighting words, because they filed another lawsuit against us claiming slander, because extortion has a legal definition and they were not using extortion. So we had to change it. We couldn't call them patent extortionists anymore or hitmen or any of those other things. So we called them patent trolls, okay? Because we looked at them as greedy little things that lived under the bridge that came out and ate the billy goats when they tried to go across. The other concept is also that troll, like when you troll for fish, you put something out there and see if you can get somebody to catch it. So it's actually a double meaning to it. The interesting thing is let's fast forward now to today, and Peter Detkin was one of the founders of Intellectual Ventures. So it's kind of interesting that the person that invented the word patent troll now works for a company that is buying patents. So it's just an interesting story. I do not want to get into a debate about what a patent troll is and whether they're good or bad or whatever. I think that what we're doing is fabulous for the industry. It's fabulous for innovation, and I hope to be able to talk to you a little bit more about that. I do want to tell you one small story. I and a couple buddies, we're going to electrical engineering school, and we had this great idea. We're going to take video from a video camera of homes, and we're going to capture that into memory, and then we're going to mimic the retina in the eye, throw away the data that the eye can't see, and store digitally the image much, much smaller than what it was before. And this was in the late 80s. So we had this great idea, and so for our a project at school, we built a frame grabber, something that would grab the video image, and we came up with a couple different video coding methods. We filed a patent on it, and we went around and started talking to companies. And the harsh reality of these things came to forefront. It was really First off, many of them didn't get it because at the time, computers, believe it or not, were mostly monochrome. And those that were color had four colors on the screen. That was it. So the concept of being able to display a full color image on a computer screen was something very foreign to them at the time. We were trying to say, no, we see where it's headed and you'll have full color screens, you know, within 5 or 6 years. Well, we wound up being right about that. And we wound up being right about image compression being a good idea. But unfortunately, we didn't license any of our patents at all. A few years later, I found myself teaming up with a bunch of other people around the world and talking about how to compress images. And we called ourselves, just for fun, the Joint Photographic Expert Group. And there was a standards, we got sponsorship from the International Standards Organization. And I was chairman of the U.S. committee and held a delegation to the international committee. I think you guys all call it JPEG nowadays. But I took all the comments of the world and did the editing on the version of JPEG, that spec, and I was the editor for the second version. I was chairman of that committee for 3.5 years, and I loved it. The fact is myself and a couple dozen people invented image compression, and none of us got rich off of it. Many, many companies have. So that's sort of my personal story, and it's sort of why I have the passion for doing this, because I've seen it, I've lived it. I've lived in your shoes, where you have a fabulous idea, and you see other people using it, and you don't know how to break through. How do you get your ideas in front of them and get something for it? Okay? So, here's the problem. This is today. You have invention, you have to go find investment, and then ultimately that results in either a business, you sell the patent, or you license the patent. That's really your three choices at this point. Okay? You can look for different types of investment. There was today at lunch at the round table, there were a couple great venture capitalists here in the area, and that is fabulous. It really is. It's great to have the possibility of doing that. There's venture capital, there's private equity, there's individual investment. When I was doing, we started a startup surrounding our image compression idea, and I actually stuck with it for almost 5 years, and most of the investment came from family and friends. It was very interesting how that worked out. University tech transfer is a possibility. Universities create a ton of intellectual property. And of course, the final bullet there, if all else fails, contingency is the way it winds up going. So right now, this is the way it works. It's one-to-one. There's not an efficient market. If you're lucky enough to find the investment, then it may lead to one of these. But you're more likely to have your invention become a hit over here. You are actually, the way I like to say it is, when I was a kid, I was in Little League. It was just as likely for me to become a pro baseball player in Little League as it was for my idea to be, you know, the next Google. All right, portfolio approach. There are some that the portfolio approach works for. Single companies, IBM, Lucent, Thomson, Philips, they have huge patent portfolios, and they make a huge amount of money licensing those patent portfolios. They use them either for a straight-out licensing program, or they use them for business development. For example, IBM will go in, and they'll talk to somebody about a license, and they'll say, you can pay us royalty, or if you buy IBM products to include in your business, then we'll give you a credit towards that royalty. So they use it actually to generate, and other companies do that as well, on large scale, small scale, and so on. But portfolios work pretty well for them. They send the license down, and the money flows back, and they make a ton of money off of licensing. Who else? There's single companies that have a narrow-focused portfolio. Two of the most popular ones are Rambus, Qualcomm, also TI to some extent. They have great patent portfolios, and they've made a lot of money off of those patent portfolios. Qualcomm makes over $1 billion a year licensing its patent portfolio. Okay, it makes more money off of licensing its patent portfolio than it does off of selling its chips. And so it really works for them. And Rambus, they make all their money off of licensing their patent portfolio and their technology. TI in the early days had a lot of the essential patents for memory. So almost all the memory makers wound up paying tons of royalties to TI. So it works for them. Why? because they have a portfolio. They've got a ton of patents. How can you, having a few patents, I don't know. They even trade each other, by the way. Believe it or not, these guys make products using these guys' technology, and they swap licenses and swap money back and forth and so forth. Then in some cases, these same big companies get together and they form a patent pool. They've done that with something called MPEG Licensing Authority, MPEG LA it's called. And if you are producing DVDs or a DVD player or something like that, you can go there and you pay a set amount and it's distributed amongst all the big companies that have contributed patents there. It's the rest of us. I think this is me. That was my buddy. Okay. Unfortunately, this is the state of affairs, to try to get them to recognize your patent. And unfortunately, it really is to this extent. In fact, these are the statistics that we've been able to put together. If you take universities, research labs, inventors, and small companies, they produce 60% of the patents. But unfortunately, they only get 1% of the revenue. Now, why is that? Inefficient market. What do we need? A low, easy way to be able to get value, okay? Today's market is just, it's fractured all over the place. There's lots of different players. There's no place to go. There's no patent store. There's no eBay for patents. There's no place that you can go and market your patent and so forth. It's difficult to match buyers and sellers. Not only that, the buyers and sellers in general, especially the ones like these with these, they don't trust each other. They want to know what you're up to. So the efficient market, that's what we're hoping for here. Allows individuals and companies to sell patents they're not using. Believe it or not, the big companies could sell patents to it too. Small inventors, universities, individual inventors, they could sell patents, but guess what? Big companies could too. And that thing I talked about before where they try to talk to each other about licensing that web browser patent that Intel invented, it actually could take place. They could actually get compensated for it if there was an efficient market, if there was a market where they could sell that patent and then get participate in it, in the licensing of it. So one of the things we would like to do is if you had an efficient market, there'd be no need to litigate. The swing for the fences wouldn't be as necessary. And it would provide, you know, buyers, sellers, and licensees, it would provide, you know, they'd understand how to do this. Efficient market and balance. So let's go back to this. We've got to figure out how to break this wall down and how to do it. So I'm going to put in a little plug, but that's what we're doing. Intellectual Ventures, this is our concept. This is our dream. This is what we're doing. And we've been more successful than we ever could have hoped. Already, okay? We have established relationships with lots of universities, lots of individual inventors, lots of Fortune 100 companies, and we have aggregated a large portfolio, and we will continue to do so. And what would happen if this portfolio was like these portfolios, that strong, that significant? Then guess what? We can play. We can go to companies and we can give licenses and we can get money back for it. And then that money can flow back to the inventors. That's our dream. That's what we're working on. And create an invention exchange. There's actually lots of money that can, it actually allows an open market where people can invest in this and get return. Okay? So somebody's got to underwrite it and fund it, and that's exactly what we hope. And once again, we can license even to these guys. We can actually get patents to flow back and forth. Well, the concept here was that they could give us a license and we could give them money and we could pool our portfolios with theirs or whatever. With an open market, it actually works. Inventors today have few options, and we do see the market starting to develop. We want to eliminate swinging for the fences. We want to eliminate the essence of the troll behavior. The troll behavior is the fact that you'll take a few patents and you'll try to go get as much money as you can through whatever means you can. In most cases, it involves attorneys and letters and so forth. But if there was an open market, it wouldn't be a need for that. Some people are proposing a complete overhaul of the patent system to solve the problem. They believe because people are being forced to sue them to get recognition for their patents, that that means the patent system is broken. I don't think that means the patent system's broken. I think it means that the market and how they acknowledge people's intellectual property, I think that's what's broken. It's far more efficient, rather than changing the laws and creating more confusion, just let the market do it. We've been in business almost 3 years now. We've been buying patents. We've been buying patents from everybody, all over the place. And guess what? Last year, patent litigation filings dropped 12%. I don't know. It may not be statistically significant or not, but we believe that it's starting to happen. The market is starting to happen. There's lots of opportunity. Embrace it. Don't resist it. That's the message that we're out giving those big companies. Okay. This is why if we're successful and others are successful, we don't necessarily want to be the only ones in this. We'd love to see many people involved in doing this sort of concept. Because if it happens, the free market forces will drive an efficient IP market. It will drive it to efficiency. Scale and aggregation, that I showed you that before. It's very important to have lots of sources of money flowing in and lots of buyers and lots of sellers, but some sort of intermediary that can bridge the gap between the two. Access to information leading to proper valuations. That's one of the biggest difficulties with doing patents is the valuation. Efficient markets providing capital and liquidity, which ultimately smooth the market for all. So, okay, what does all this mean? Let's talk about patents for a little bit, okay? That's sort of what some of you thought you were going to talk about. There's been a significant increase in awareness of IP in the market in the last 24 months. You've heard about it. You've heard the news articles. You've heard about Supreme Court ruling on an eBay versus Merck exchange. You've heard about, it's funny. They said that the cool table at the Supreme Court cafeteria is now being occupied by IP attorneys. What is going on? I mean, the world is out of control. There's a lot of visibility right now on IP in the market and patents and so forth. There's an increase in supply and demand. One of the things that when we started doing this is we didn't really understand how big this market was going to be. And we hoped that we'd be able to put together a portfolio of a few thousand patents. Well, we did that a lot faster than we thought. And now we're trying to understand, how big is the market and how many places can the market be in. There's increase of capital flowing into the market, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the players there. There's more large companies looking at the sale of their own IP. For example, they shut down a division, they're no longer in that business. What do they do to try to monetize that research and development? There's more individuals and small companies with quality IP that are also looking to sell. Impact of supply is the supply increase actually continues to keep the price steady. So that's that economic thing, supply and demand. As long as demand is increasing and supply is not keeping up with it, then the prices will continue to at least stay steady or maybe even increase. Increase competition, that's exactly it. So what we're hoping for is fewer uncontested bankruptcy dissolution opportunities. Right now, if you want, companies don't make it. Unfortunately, innovators don't necessarily make the best business people, okay? And that's why it's important if you are going to do a spin out or try to build a business around an innovation that you get a great executive team on board. And people like venture capital firms and boards of advisors and stuff like that can really help a lot with that. But in some cases, it still doesn't work out. So what happens? There's intellectual property there. And what we're hoping is that it doesn't mean that all the value is gone. There can still be some value there. More agents running processes. There's more people selling patents now that are doing things like auctions and things of that nature. You probably heard about patent auctions happening. Further increases in capital will continue to increase prices and competition. So who's selling patents right now? Not that any of you are going to be buying patents, but maybe you are. I don't know. This is where patents are coming from. They're coming from bankruptcies, distressed companies, inventors, small companies. There's an interesting phenomenon with them. Everybody thinks their children are beautiful. It's just the way it is, okay? When you invent something, you think it's the greatest thing in the world. You think it's worth millions and millions of dollars. The reality is that, you know, the new way to dissipate heat in a power supply may not be worth millions and millions of dollars. It's a great idea, okay, but it may not be worth it. And even my image compression idea, what I found out once I went to work at Intel was they didn't really care about the image compression algorithm. They didn't care whether it was, you know, Fourier-based or fractal-based or whatever. They didn't care because they would manufacture and build the best engine anyway. So the technology was less a key important part of building their product line. It was their capital investment and their manufacturing expertise and so on. So the reality is that even though we think that it's, you know, our technology and our invention is, you know, we're in love with it. We think it's wonderful. And many small companies, their patent is basically the only asset the company really has. They have some technology, and they're out there trying to get somebody to take a look at it. Okay? They are not really manufacturing product yet or anything like that. And so they become very passionate about it. They become so close to it that they think it's just worth a lot. So it's very important to try to bridge the gap there, to have some place that can give legitimate valuations for people. Universities are selling. The beautiful thing about universities is there's an opportunity for innovation outside the bounds of some strategic direction or product of a company. It's fabulous, and it's a gathering together of some great minds and a chance for innovation, and they need a path to be able to monetize those. Of course, there's a few that are really valuable, but what about the rest of them? Big companies, they don't usually have a large licensing program, and companies in transition, we like to talk about Moore's Law victims, people who their product suddenly has become obsolete because computer power has, you know, just multiplied, you know, and therefore their products are no longer that relevant, but they still have relevant patents. Let's talk about a patent portfolio. Your typical patent portfolio has a very, very small percent of that portfolio is extremely high-valued patents. Okay? And I don't care who you're talking about. You're talking about what's created in the University of California system. You're talking about what's created in a company like Intel. You're talking about what's created when you get yourself and a couple buddies in the room. A small percentage of the patents will actually be extremely high value. And you know what you should do with those? You should find people to implement them and build businesses around them. You know, the patents that came out of Stanford that Google is based on, those are extremely high-value patents, and the right thing to do was to do a startup with that. And then if you have products, you need to keep some patents for defensive value, to trade, to cross-license, and so on, when other people come to you with patent assertions who are also making product. So we understand this. We understand that even as much as 50% of a portfolio might want to be retained because that's sort of, you know, the value. But no matter who you are, there's a lot of patents. Very often it's 50% or more of the portfolio that doesn't have value strategically to whoever's holding it. So what do you do with those? Well, guess what? If there was a market, you could make money on them. And not only that, if somebody else decides to pick it up and run with it, you might even make more money on it. I remember when I was at Intel over the period of time, I think I filed about 60 different patent disclosures over that period of time, and they wound up only filing 20 of them. Why? Because 40 of them were not strategic to Intel. They weren't a new billion-dollar business, okay? Or they weren't incremental improvements on a billion-dollar business. So what happened? We had this room, we called it the Room of Lost Souls. It was file cabinets full of fabulous ideas, many of which were $100 million companies that are just sitting there. And nobody's going to use them, nobody's going to file the patent for them, nobody's going to give them life. Okay? And maybe sooner or later somebody else comes up with it independently. But unfortunately, that's what's happening everywhere. It's happening here in this university because they have budgets. Unfortunately, they've only got so many patents that they can file. It's happening at companies, it's happening everywhere. So why not? make it so that something can happen with those. Lots of companies are buying. Why are companies buying? Because they're getting into new businesses, and they understand when they get into businesses, they're building on the shoulders of others, and consequently, they're going to look and try to buy the intellectual property related to that. Who's buying? Yahoo, Amazon, Time Warner, Novell, Thomson, GE. These are the people that we've seen out there buying patents. We're not the only ones. They all buy patents. Intel buys patents. Everybody buys patents, okay? And they do it for lots of different reasons. So it's very interesting that it's okay for them to buy patents, but it's not okay for a patent-holding company to buy patents, okay? And that's sort of playing both sides of the equation. And so it's rather interesting. There are big companies. Who else is buying? There's companies that are coordinating efforts. Sedna is created by Cox. It's actually a lot of the, I forget how many of the different players, but it's the cable industry, basically, has gone together, and they're buying patents that would be applicable to the cable industry. And they have a fund, and they've done at least four acquisitions for $50 million in the last few years. There's a company called ThinkFire. And ThinkFire is actually working as a broker to buy patents for some of their customers, some of their clients. And they actually coordinated the efforts of multiple companies to participate in a bid for patents, Commerce One. Commerce One patents were bought by Novell for, I think, $19 million, but ThinkFire was there bidding on behalf of their client base. There's always a possibility that a company like that could start a fund of their own. There's also something, an open source fund. You probably heard about that. They call it OINK. OINK, OINK, and that is basically they're trying to get patents related to open source and put them together and then give them to anyone doing open source. So it's an open license sort of thing. There's other funds. There's something at Rembrandt, Altitude, and Oshitomo. Maybe you've heard about the Oshitomo auction. They did an auction, I think, in San Francisco. Then more recently, they did one in New York. And in addition to a bunch of patents, they actually even auctioned off Jimi Hendrix music and things like that. So it was rather interesting. But all of these people are active. So these are the people that are also pursuing just a pure patent licensing. Acacia, they're reasonably well-funded. They seem to be gaining traction. It's interesting because they have a ton of investment and have hardly made any revenue per se, if you check on their website. But they seem to be actually buying small portfolios solely for the purpose of, you know, licensing those on a one-by-one fashion. Mosaid was a Canadian company. They actually did a lot of semiconductor manufacturing in the early days. They've phased out all their product line now, and they're building a portfolio license. Yes?
Originally, you talked a lot about privacy licenses.
It's important if you're going to build a portfolio to put together the rights to the patents. So if you purchase it from someone who doesn't want to sell you the patent but they want to sell you the rights, then you can get an exclusive license. So for example, with many of the universities, we wind up getting an exclusive license to the patents, and they wind up participating quite a bit in, you know, the returns that we eventually get. But they continue to own the patents, and they continue to be able to develop them and build upon them and so forth. It's also possible whenever we buy patents that, you know, for example, if you have a small company and you've come up with some great innovations and you want to try to monetize your patents, that's fine. You can sell the patents, and we give you a license back to produce the products. So you're not giving up your right and your ability to do that. You get to continue to build that, and it's another source of income for you. Did that answer your question? Thank you. So there's a lot of law firms still doing the contingency, and in fact, that's the number one competitor to putting together a patent portfolio, is keeping it, is keeping the patents out of the hands of the contingency attorneys that try to build very large expectations for people. So this is just basically, you know, keep your eyes open, understand what's going on out there, stay on top of the evolving market, rethink your portfolio, and understand new opportunities exist. Strategically thinking company can help shape a market. They really can. eBay's done it. BMI, ASCAP's done it. Ticketmaster's done it. You can do this. You can rethink. You can help establish a market. So That's pretty much the speech. So I want to open it up, get a chance for you guys to talk, ask questions. There was a lot of great questions and interaction about, you know, our, you know, how we do it, how we buy patents, how we value them, all those things over lunch. This sort of gives you an idea of what it is we're trying to establish. Now the floor is yours. Okay. I think they want you to wait for the microphone so they can get it on them.
I'm sure there's established algorithms, but how do you value a patent? What do you do when somebody comes in with a patent? How do you set a number on it?
That's a very good question, and it is the most difficult part of building a portfolio is understanding the valuation. If the patent's currently being used and you have an understanding of how the patent's currently being used, it is somewhat, I mean, you can do numbers and you can try to understand what is, you know, the impact to the products that are being built out there and what portion is attributable to the patent, and then come up with some sort of reasonable royalty, and then factor in some risk factors, because patents are never a sure thing, and you can come up with some evaluation. So in those cases, it's a little bit easier. The real difficult time comes when nobody's using it yet, but you think it's going to be the next greatest thing in the world. And this is pretty much when you get to like a venture capital type of modeling for the valuation. You have to try to understand what's the potential and how many alternatives are there, what's the potential return, how big can the market be, and factor in a ton of risk as well and come up with a valuation there. Another way to do it is also when there's a lot of patents that aren't necessarily market-creating patents. They're patents that are incremental improvements, or, you know, it takes a whole handful of them to create, you know, a reasonable device. If you talk about something like, you know, your cell phone, this device probably has 1,000 patents that would read on it. Something related to the display, the memory card, the antenna, you know, the technologies used to digitize the voice and all that. So there's probably 1,000 patents in there. So how much is one additional patent on this worth? Well, that's a very interesting interesting question. And one of the ways you could do it is you could just say, how much did they spend to get a patent? And is this better, or, you know, is this more valuable than average or less valuable than the cost of getting it? And try to build something up there when you're talking about 1,000 patents, and then trying to understand what really is a reasonable contribution to a venture licensing program. So it is one of the most difficult parts of it, and that's why it's difficult for someone to build a portfolio. You really have to have that type of expertise. And the team that we have doing our valuation is led by a handful of very senior people, all of them 20 years or more experience building products, bringing products to the industry, and a lot of patent expertise as well on top of that. And then we also have a lot of research that goes in behind that, understanding markets and products and things of that nature. Thank you. Next question.
You mentioned you had a handshake agreement here with UCSB. Could you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, we've done a number of deals with the University of California system, and previous to this, we'd done several deals with University of California San Diego, and we'd done one deal with UCSB. We have been talking to them about some patents in their portfolio that we think would be a good addition to our portfolio. The University of California system owns about 6,600 patents, and unfortunately they make 80% of their money off of, I think, the top five. Okay? So how do you rationalize the rest of that? And so what we're doing is we're trying to say, let us bring you, you know, smaller amounts of money, but it's money that can flow to professors to give them the incentive to continue to innovate. In other words, to truly create the market and do it. So I don't feel comfortable right now talking about the size of it, but it's the largest deal that we've done with the University of California system, and we're just excited as can be, because I think a lot of great technologies, especially those ones that can be brought together in a portfolio and create a lot of value, and the University of California Santa Barbara actually participates when we license those patents. So we're hoping that it's a partnership that'll lead to a lot of really good future results. Okay? Thank you. Right here.
With the presence of an emerging global market, and like when you were working at Intel, I'm sure that you dealt with companies that were overseas or whatnot, but had a global presence, and they can read a, you know, they can go on the United States patent website just like anybody else, read a patent, and do the same thing. How's the legal landscape when you're dealing in a global playing field, and especially because it's more relevant today than maybe 10 years ago?
That's also an excellent question. One of the interesting things is if you look at the top 10 filers and issuers of patents in the United States, the companies that are in the top 10, half of them are not U.S.-based companies. And they're getting patents here in the U.S. And not only that, when you look at some of the emerging markets like China, what's going to happen there? China's pumping out 10 times more engineers every year than we are here in the United States. What does that mean for the future? Anybody, anywhere in the world, can file a patent in the United States. They can file a patent in the UK. They can file a patent. There's even a patent cooperative treaty where you file it there, and you can actually go to a national phase in 40 different countries. Okay, so it's actually very, very interesting because it is a global market for patents. And one of the things that we do is we buy assets all around the world, and we try to understand the market as a whole. Let me give you one example of one of the interesting dichotomies that are created. In Korea, like many of the Asian countries, much of the industry, much of the daily life of people revolves around a few companies. For example, if you work for Samsung, chances are you live in a Samsung apartment building. Chances are you drive a car made by a Samsung partner, and you buy Samsung televisions and so on and so forth. And not only that, you probably, you know, you go on vacations to Samsung resorts and things of that nature. So it becomes very interesting because there are still some research organizations and universities in Korea, but unfortunately, in most cases, they've been forced to take their research money from the few companies. And consequently, their flow of intellectual property has gone to those companies. And that's okay. I mean, it's part of the system, and it's good for corporations to invest in, you know, research and so on. But one of the issues that can come up is if, for example, what's happening there right now, they're implementing a technology called WiBro. And WiBro is an early version of WiMAX. Maybe you've heard of WiMAX because everybody's talking about it. They're going to implement it here in the United States in a couple years. They're still finishing the standard. They're pretty close. Well, right now they're laying the lines and putting it up in Korea. They're getting a ton of implementation and application experience, and they're creating a lot of intellectual property. And trust me, they're filing those patents in the United States. So what's going to happen when we go to roll it out here in the United States? Well, chances are we'll have a body of intellectual property that's going to have to be reckoned with that is not open and available. So it would be our goal to go in, get a relationship with, you know, Korea Telecom and the research organizations and the universities, for example, in Korea, and have them, you know, open up their innovation for the world to be able to build upon. That's the vision of what we want to do.